This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When people look back on the language of the early years of the 21st century, the first thing that will come to mind is the political vocabulary and the language of real estate. That's what Fresh Air's linguist Jeff Nunberg thinks. He's been looking back on the language of this decade for his new book, The Years of Talking Dangerously. It's a collection of his pieces for Fresh Air, The New York Times, and other publications. Jeff says this decade will evoke political language, just as the 60s evoked the language of rock, drugs, and disaffection, the 70s, the language of disco and new age, the 80s, management jargon and valley girl slang, and the 90s, techno talk and fitness speak. Jeff Nunberg teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley and is the chairman emeritus of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. Jeff says a lot of the words and catchphrases that were used earlier this decade, including in the 2008 presidential campaign, have lost their power. Take the word elite, which is how candidate Obama was described by some Republicans.
Elite was certainly a word that, almost as much as any other, stands in for the cultural politics of the last few decades, beginning really with Spiro Agnew in the end of the Nixon years, and continuing through the 90s. You remember Dan Quayle's railing about Murphy Brown and the cultural elite, and up to the present. And over the course of time, it's acquired a meaning that had, particularly for the right, had less to do with having real wealth and influence and so on than with the sorts of things you buy and your attitude. As long as you think you're regular folks, you're not elite, or an elite, as they say now. Elites, as they say it, are people who look down on the regular people, so that you can get that you have the spectacle of a people who would, by any traditional definition, qualify as more than elite, throwing the word around in a dismissive way. The height of this was during the campaign, when Lady Lynn Forrester de Rothschild, the American millionairess who married a titled Englishman, went on Wolf Blitzer and said that she wasn't going to vote for the Democrats because Barack Obama was an elitist who looked down on the common people. Now, this was a spectacle so remarkable that even people on the right felt a certain distance from it. But at the same time, the way the word is used by people like Ann Coulter and Laura Ingraham, Ivy-educated lawyers from privileged backgrounds, gives a sense that it simply has nothing to do with money and power anymore, but merely a question of attitude.
Jeff, your previous book was called Talking Right, How Conservatives Turned Liberalism into a Tax-Raising, Latte-Drinking, Sushi-Eating, Volvo-Driving, New York Times-Reading, Body-Piercing, Hollywood-Loving, Left-Wing Freak Show. And the premise of that book, the previous book, was that the Republicans had succeeded in packaging their message in catchy slogans and that the Democrats should learn from that. Now that you see a lot of those catchy slogans as having kind of petered out and that they're not going to be effective anymore, what do you think of the of the thesis of the previous book? Have you changed your mind about that? Do you think that the Republicans no longer have the monopoly on the catchy phrases?
Well, I do think certainly the Republicans no longer have a monopoly. I think it began to unravel just after the 2004 elections. You could put the moment just before the 2006 election when Bush said to George Stephanopoulos, "We've never been stay the course." Even Fox News couldn't resist showing all the footage of Bush saying stay the course. But that began a series of slogan recalls so that wanted dead or alive morphed into I don't know where he is and I frankly don't, I'm not that concerned. And just before the 2008 election, Bush was asked if he had any regrets. And he mentioned the mission accomplished banner aboard the USS Lincoln in 2003 and said, I was trying to express myself. I could have expressed myself more artfully. Now, in retrospect, that's certainly true. I'm sure the advanced people for that particular speech wish in retrospect that they'd gone with something a little more noncommittal, like way to go, guys, or something like that. But what you saw was in that period, the language of the Bush administration, with which they had so skillfully dominated the political discourse over the first 4 or 5 years, just crumble. And it crumbled not because it wasn't sufficiently artful, and certainly not because the Democrats made any inroads or were particularly skillful in using language themselves, but just because of the structure fatigue, if you want to call it that, based on trying to span this increasing gap between words and reality.
Do you feel like you're listening to both Democrats and Republicans now trying to come up with new phrases, with a new language, to describe their positions in ways that they hope will catch on?
Yeah, the Republicans certainly are trying to find new ways of turning their populism from cultural to economic issues. And I think these cries of socialist and socialistic have a lot to do with that. The Democrats, on the other hand, have the same problem. What's extraordinary about the Obama election was he did it really without language. He was so skillful at speaking and conveying his message without using buzzwords and the like that he could get enormous mileage out of these essentially empty words like hope and change that nobody else, everybody else tried it. Nobody else could use those words the way he could. But they have no content. They're not the kind of words you can hand over to somebody else in the hope that they'll be able to use them. Unlike the Republicans' language, the extraordinary thing about the values talk was that it could be used effectively not just by an effective, charismatic speaker like Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush, but by characters like John Kyle and Mitch McConnell, who, whatever their considerable political gifts, are not what you'd think of as charismatic, but they can use this language and get mileage out of it too. The Democrats don't have language like that right now.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeff Nunberg, who often comments about language on Fresh Air. And he has a new book called The Years of Talking Dangerously. That's a collection of his Fresh Air pieces, as well as pieces from The New York Times and other publications. I'm sure you've been keeping up with not only the debate about torture, but the debate over what word to use to describe the interrogation techniques that were used. And some people have been using torture for a long time. Some publications say you can't use the word torture because that's illegal. There's a legal definition of torture. And when they were doing it, they had a legal definition that was different, courtesy of John Yoo and others in the Office of Legal Counsel. So what are you hearing when you hear the debate about whether, when it's appropriate to use the word torture, and if not that word, what word should be used?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that right after the Abu Ghraib story broke 5 years ago, all the European papers right away were using torture. The British, German, French press, left and right, not just The Guardian, but Rupert Murdoch's Times were calling it torture. And the American press then and now have been very reluctant to use that word. And they have this idea, well, it's a legal category. That's because the administration insists it's a legal category and have defined it in a way such that these things won't count as torture in the legal sense. The administration's definition obviously doesn't have any broader legal significance, even beyond the administration, much less on a world scale. And more to the point, it's an English word. And the moral judgment that attaches to torture doesn't have to do with its legal status. It has to do with looking at these acts and describing them as torture. So that somehow if the administration was talking as if we can keep that word at bay, we can keep at bay the moral disapproval that comes with it. So you got all these terms like alternative sets of procedures and vigorous questioning and, of course, enhanced interrogation techniques, which people are still trying to use. And with that came this word professionals that Bush kept using. He said, these are our professionals. We want our professionals to know that they can do this in a profession, which suggests not simply that they know what they're doing, but that they're not taking any pleasure in it. So I think this is a perfect example of the way in which the word you choose determines whether you think something's all right or not. Not the thing itself, but the way you choose to name it. It's something you see not just with torture, with suicide, for example. If you ask people in a poll, is it okay for doctors to help terminally ill patients end their lives, you get a lot more people saying yes than if you ask them if it's okay for doctors to help terminally ill patients commit suicide. And again, this is a semantic debate. The important thing to realize is that there's nothing merely semantic about it.
For the past couple of years, we've all had to, if we want to know what's happening in the economic world, we've had to learn words like credit default swaps and derivatives and all of this, financially technical language that those of us who aren't intimately involved with Wall Street are having to learn to make sense of what's going on. And I guess I'm interested in your observations on all of us struggling to learn that language.
There's a sense certainly in which we feel if we can learn the language and learn to use the words, we'll somehow be able to understand what's going on. And if we understand it, it won't be quite as frightening. And journalists have done in recent times a pretty good job on helping people to understand, at least the people who want to understand these things. But the facts, as Walter Lippmann said, exceed our curiosity. I don't think people are ever really going to be able to understand the ins and outs of this crisis, just because obviously so many regulators and people in Congress weren't able to. And in a funny way, the effort to master the language of economics and finance takes away from the immediate experience. I was thinking of this because there's a line in a Bruce Springsteen song when one of the characters says, "Lately, times ain't been too good on account of the economy." And it occurred to me that 40 or 50 years ago, if Woody Guthrie had written that song, 60, 70 years ago for Guthrie, he wouldn't have said on account of the economy. He would have said on account of times are hard. And it strikes me that that's exactly what's going on now. We don't know if it's a pullback or a depression or a bad recession or what. What we do know is that times are hard. And in a funny way, maybe that's the language we should be using, because it's the language that grows out of our immediate experience of what's going on.
I think a part of the urge to understand credit default swaps and derivatives and all that stuff is to know, like, who got us into this mess and who should we be holding accountable and what should we change for the future in terms of regulation. And that's where times are hard doesn't get you very far.
Well, I think that's right. And there's a difference between knowing the technical mechanics, so to speak, of what's been going on and trying to get a grip on it. And that's something that a lot of people, myself included, are trying to do. And trying to understand what's actually going on in the world. And we don't want to lose sight when people use these words like recession and downturn and whatever. Not that the words are inaccurate, but they don't grow right out of the experience that people are having. And in that sense, something like hard times, I'd like to see that phrase resuscitated and brought back just to describe what's actually going on in America. I don't think the two are at odds with one another. You can, on the one hand, try as best you can to develop an understanding of what's going on and who's to blame. At the same time, look at what's going on in the country and describe it in words that grow out of the situation itself, the words that ordinary people use that they understand and what's going on in terms of what's going on in their lives.
Now, one of the things I learned from your book is that you sometimes edit Wikipedia entries. I always wonder who are the people who are actually editing, you know, revising Wikipedia entries when they spot an error. And you don't do it often, but you're apparently one of those people. So what are your criteria for saying, okay, I'm actually going to go ahead and make the change? Because, I mean, I've seen errors. I haven't tried to correct them.
Well, I think there are two reasons why one will be. There are people who just spend all their time doing this, and more power to them. There are two reasons I find for going to edit an entry. One is when I come up with some cool observation and go to see if Wikipedia has it and they don't. So, for example, Colin Farrell in the opening sequence of a movie, the name of which I forget, sings "I Fought the Law" in the persona of the character he plays in the movie. And I went to Wikipedia. It wasn't there, but there is an entry for "I Fought the Law," so I added that. Facts about Brian Horwitz, San Francisco Giant outfielder, briefly a San Francisco Giant outfielder, and so forth. On the other hand, sometimes you'll see something really stupid in a Wikipedia article or just wildly incorrect, and then you also feel an obligation to go in and try to correct it. Though there, what often happens is you try to make the correction and other people come back and correct your correction and you wind up going back and forth. It's a frustrating process, and sometimes you just throw your hands up. A friend of mine, colleague Paul Duguid at the School of Information, went in to try to fix the article on Daniel Defoe, which he noted had 5 factual errors in its first 2 sentences. And he went through a long, months-long battle, struggle to get these right. And at the end of 3 months, those 2 sentences had 9 factual errors.
So, reader, beware. What has this done to your sense of how to use Wikipedia and when to rely on it and when not to?
You know, I think the interesting thing is people are getting very – it's an invaluable and it's also a menace. And everybody knows that. And I think the trick is to know when you can rely on Wikipedia. I mean, if you want to know who were all the guys in Humble Pie who weren't Peter Frampton, who but Wikipedia is going to know that? When did Barry Bonds win the MVP, the National League MVP award for the first time? There's 7,000 people contributing to the Barry Bonds article, and it's not conceivable that they could collectively get that wrong. Anything about Harry Potter or Star Trek, you can be dead sure that the Wikipedia article is right. When it comes to other topics, the English language, Daniel Defoe, Max Beerbohm, or as you know, Fresh Air, you have to be a little more careful about interpreting what the collective wisdom is.
Jeff, if you had to choose like one source to eavesdrop on or to read, to see how language is changing, what would it be? Taking Google out of the picture, because that would be cheating.
Wow. I might want to read my daughter's Facebook page, but though I have access, it's only through a thin window, and she's got the settings fixed, so I don't get to see any of that stuff. And probably I wouldn't want to see it for other reasons. But I think that one of the interesting things is that with Facebook and email and the Google groups and blog comments and so on, you can get a look at the language of groups like young people or social groups that haven't been participating in written discourse, whose writing and whose language was never publicly visible before. So you don't have to go around with a tape recorder the way people have done, although that still helps. But you can actually go on, say, Google Groups and see how people are talking, actual people are talking.
In your new book, Jeff, you mention one of your English teachers in I guess it was in high school, Mrs. Bosch, who was like really a stickler for correcting grammatical errors and things like that. Was that helpful or just irritating?
I think everybody has to have an English teacher like Mrs. Bosch if you want to learn to write well. Mrs. Bosch is the English teacher who with withering sarcasm, dismisses all the errors and grammatical solecisms in her students' papers. So somebody has the misfortune to write, having been thrown in the air, the dog caught the stick, or something like that. And Mrs. Bosch is the one who says, the poor dog being thrown in the air like that. And you're in seventh grade or eighth grade, and you laugh. You're being let in on this secret. So you have to have a teacher like that. And then at some point later in life, you have to renounce her and then finally forgive her. And that's the point in which you become, let me say, a mature speaker of English. And the trouble is that a lot of people kind of never get over that moment. They're the people who write comments on any blog entry or newspaper article that involves grammar, going on sarcastically about someone else's use of language. And the sarcasm that people apply to language is really something that they learn in seventh grade and kind of never overcome. It's what's wrong with the way people think about language nowadays.
Why is it wrong? Because the people who do that, and you know, I've been the target of many corrections over the years, the people who do that think, A, they're doing you a favor, and B, they're right, and therefore they almost have an obligation to let you know that you've made a mistake. So what do you think is the problem and the motivation?
Well, I don't think the motivation is merely to inform someone else. That can be done when it's appropriate, and it usually isn't. But when it's appropriate, it can be done graciously without sarcasm. The sarcasm comes when, somebody writes in broad daylight and somebody says, why, could there have been narrow daylight? And it's this adolescent way of congratulating yourself on having mastered the elements of English grammar when you were 13. And it's kind of stupid because the things you learn at 13, while they're the basics, are hardly the source of should hardly be the source of enormous self-esteem. I mean, if it's really a source of self-esteem for you that you know the correct rules for using the apostrophe, maybe you should get out more.
And this is coming from a linguist. Well, Jeff, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It's great to talk with you. Thank you.
Jeffrey Nunberg's new book is called The Years of Talking Dangerously. Jeff is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information of the University of California at Berkeley, and he's chairman emeritus of the Usage Panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I am Frau Blücher.
Steady!
How do you do? I am Dr. Frankenstein. This is my assistant, Inga. May I present Frau Blücher? I wonder what's got into them.
Your rooms have been prepared, Herr Doctor. If you will follow me.
Igor, would you bring the bags as soon as you're finished, please?
Yes, Master.
After you, Frau Blücher.
That was my guest, Cloris Leachman, as Frau Blücher, with Gene Wilder as Dr. Frankenstein, in a scene from the Mel Brooks movie Young Frankenstein. Leachman also co-starred in the Mel Brooks movie High Anxiety. She won an Oscar for her performance in the 1971 film The Last Picture Show. On the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Cloris Leachman played Mary's neighbor and landlady, Phyllis, which led to her own spin-off series, Phyllis, in 1975. More recently, she co-starred in the 2004 film Spanglish. And last year, she became something of a phenomenon when, at the age of 82, she became the oldest contestant ever on Dancing with the Stars. Cloris Leachman has written a new autobiography, which includes a section on Dancing with the Stars. You write that you had to pass a three-hour rehearsal and to list physical problems, which for you included osteoporosis, asthma, 28% lung capacity, a bad knee, and high blood pressure. Your doctor didn't think your knee was strong enough to do Dancing with the Stars, and he wouldn't sign off on you doing it, so you just found another doctor. So what was it like when your partner did that lift and spin thing?
I wouldn't do it. It was too scary. It was so scary.
Describe the move.
He grabs my right hand and my right foot. And then you let go of your life. And oh, it's all right when you're a child. You don't have the kind of weight you do as an adult. To give that up is just, you know you're going to die. There's no doubt about it.
And you did it. I mean, you went through with the move.
And I died. It felt like I was dying. I had to do it on The View after I was voted off in the seventh week. And he did it twice on the show. Because we didn't do it correctly. I don't know, we lost about six measures the night of Dancing with the Stars. And he said, do it. Okay. And I put my arm and my leg out, and we did it. But we'd already lost six measures, so he was only able to throw me around twice. But on The View, we did it the proper amount of time, which was eight measures. So I went around eight times, and when I got up, I knew that I was dead. There wasn't any doubt about it. And they saw how I was. They brought me a chair. And it took me about, 5 or 10 minutes to recover.
I want to talk about some of your movies. You've made, two or three movies with Mel Brooks. The first was Young Frankenstein, in which you played Frau Blücher.
Blücher.
I want to play a scene from this. So just to set it up, Gene Wilder plays Dr. Frederick Frankenstein, who is the...
Frankenstein. Igor.
And he's the grandson of the famous mad scientist who created the monster. And then
he was my boyfriend.
Then he learns he's inherited the Frankenstein estate. So he goes to the mansion in Transylvania. And your character, Frau Blücher, is one of the servants there. And she was in love with the mad scientist. And in this scene, Gene Wilder, the young Dr. Frankenstein, goes to the lab. With his two assistants, where he finds you releasing the monster from his restraints. Here's the scene.
Frau Blücher!
Stop!
Don't come closer! What are you doing?
I'm going to set him free! No! No, you mustn't! Yes!
Are you insane? He'll kill you!
No, he won't. Not this one. He is as gentle as a lamb.
Stand back! Stand back! For the love of God, he has a rotten brain!
It's not rotten. It's a good bread.
It's rotten, I tell you, rotten.
Ixnay on the otten ray.
I'm not afraid. I know what he likes.
That music.
Yes, it's in your blood. It's in the blood of all Frankensteins. It erases the soul when words are useless. Your grandfather used to play it to the creature he was making.
And it was you all the time.
Yes.
You played that music in the middle of the night.
Yes.
To get us into the laboratory.
Yes.
That was your cigar smoldering in the ashtray.
Yes.
And it was you who left my grandfather's book out for me to find.
Yes.
So that I would...
Yes.
Then you and Victor were...
Yes. Yes. Say it. He was my boyfriend.
My guest, Cloris Leachman,
oh,
with Gene
God,
Wilder.
Can you believe it's the same one who played on Raymond? I love Raymond.
Oh, Peter Boyle, who plays the monster. Yeah.
Isn't it remarkable to be the same person who's doing those very divergent roles?
Oh, yeah. He was a great actor. He was a great actor. Well, how did you figure out how to play Frau Brücher?
Brücher. I didn't know. I had a wonderful hairdo by Mary, the head of the hair department, and a 20th, and a wonderful costume. They made it fit me perfectly, and it was wonderfully designed. And that's all I knew, and I was made up. Now I go on the set, and I don't have any idea how to be Frau Brücher or have any German accent. I'd never done one before. So all the time when they were shooting, I kept saying, do you know a German accent? Hello, excuse me. Do you know a German accent? To everybody. And about three people there thought they didn't know for sure. They tried. And I think one of them was Mel Brooks' mother. I think she helped me the most.
Was she from Germany?
I don't know anything. When I first came out the door and I say, I am Frau Blücher. And I think it said with such measurement, I was so careful to try to do it right. That's why it's so slow. Otherwise, I'd say, I am Frau Blücher. But I said, I am Frau Blücher.
The running gag in Young Frankenstein is whenever anybody says Frau Blücher, the horses whinny.
Mel told me a few years ago that Blücher meant glue. I'm not sure that's true, but it sure is funny.
So it's like they're threatening the horses with the glue factory. So what did you learn about comedy working with Mel Brooks?
I'll tell you one thing. I was going up the steps with Gene and the other two, remember in the castle, I'm going to show them around. And I had a candelabra, and with the candles not lit. And I turn, I say, stay close to the candles. The staircase can be treacherous. And then Mel came up to me, climbed up the steps and whispered in my ear. And it was a line reading. And here it is. Stay close to the candles. The staircase can be treacherous. Which means we've already lost a couple of people.
I want to play a scene from another Mel Brooks movie that you were in, High Anxiety. I love this film. This is a parody of a lot of different Alfred Hitchcock films. And Mel Brooks plays a psychiatrist who's become the new director of the Institute for the Very, Very Nervous.
And Dr. Ashley felt that color has a great deal to do with the well-being of the emotionally disturbed.
And you're the very severe Nurse Diesel. And in this scene, Mel Brooks, the new head of the Institute, is in his room at the Institute, and he hears screams coming from your room, and he's very concerned, so he knocks on your door, and you come out in a hooded terry cloth robe. Here's the scene.
Is everything all right in there? Nurse Diesel, are you all right?
Yes.
We heard some weird noises emanating from your room. We were worried.
Weird noises. It was the TV. Sorry it disturbed you. Turned it down. there anything else? It is rather late.
No, we were concerned. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Good night.
And as the scene continues, Nurse Diesel, played by my guest Clarice Leachman, goes back to her room, takes off her bathrobe, and underneath the robe, she's in full dominatrix regalia. She's wearing a policeman's hat and shirt, leather shorts, high leather boots. She opens her closet, and inside is Dr. Montague, played by Harvey Korman, hanging from chains in full bondage.
Who was it?
It was Thorndyke. You're making too much noise.
I can't help it. You're hurting me. You're going too hard tonight.
Oh, get off it. I know you better than you know yourself. You live for bondage and discipline.
Too much bondage, not enough discipline.
You want discipline? I'll keep the discipline.
Yes! Yes, I'm sorry! Yes, Charlotte, it's so good!
That's such a funny scene. I guess Clarice Leachman with Harvey Korman in Mel Brooks's High Anxiety. It must have been so much fun to shoot that scene. Was it hard to get through it? I mean, to like open the door and see Harvey Korman hanging there.
Oh, no, we're all serious, just playing our parts. There's another scene that is so hilarious to me. I'm just sick that they had to cut it out. But Princess of Monaco, Princess Grace.
Grace Kelly?
Yeah. She was going to see that movie that night at 20th, and he was worried about including this scene, so he cut it out and forgot to put it back in, or they didn't have time. But to me, it's hysterical. I again take off my hood, and I'm in snakes, and they're wrapped around my big, huge breasts. Then right between my legs is a long panel, and I have very high heels on. And I go to my closet, open the door, and hang up my hooded robe and make my way to my bed in these high heels. I throw myself in the bed on my back with my arms and legs out, and you hear... and you see, you're the camera now, and the camera starts from the floor up to the bed, and I'm lying there, keeps going higher, 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 higher. Finally, it's up in the ceiling, and there's Harvey Korman hanging from chains over me, exactly my shape, arms and legs out, and he says something funny, but he thought it was a little racy to show. I'm sorry, I hope he puts it back in sometime or includes it in a, with a DVD.
So he really took it out so as not to offend Grace Kelly?
Yeah. I mean, she was a little rabbit. I don't know why he thought she wasn't.
You mentioned your big breasts in the movie. You have these big fake, conical breasts underneath your clothing, and so you have these big pointy protrusions sticking out of your clothing. Describe the look that you came up with for
well,
Nurse Diesel.
When I walked into their wardrobe department, they put this dress on me and zipped it up, and it fit perfectly with these big conical breasts. And but I looked like an unborn gosling. It didn't fit me, my whoever the personality was. So I said, let's put a little something on my back, a little fatten that up. Gave me a little, hump on my back, and that balanced the breasts better, if you want to call them breasts. And then I said, I'd like to have a short neck. So they put some padding in my shoulders, but it was on the sides, and it didn't work, so we took that out. And then I had them put it right on top of my shoulders. And that raised these breasts up under my chin. And so it was wonderful.
Now, we've been focusing on your comedic roles, but you won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for a dramatic role in the movie The Last Picture Show, which is, from 1971? Is that 1971? Mm-hmm. And in this, you play a kind of depressed, middle-aged housewife who's neglected by her husband, who's the high school basketball coach and maybe gay. And she wants to experience love and have an affair. She has an affair with a teenager played by Timothy Bottoms, but he's been getting involved with a girl his age and neglecting you. And in this scene, he comes to your door and asks for a cup of coffee. You're in your bathrobe. You pour the coffee with very shaking hands and then throw the cup against the wall.
apologizing to you. Why am I always apologizing to you, you little bastard? 3 months I've been apologizing to you without you even being here. I haven't done anything wrong. Why can't I quit apologizing? You're the one ought to be sorry. I wouldn't still be in my bathrobe if it hadn't been for you. I had my clothes on hours ago. You're the one made me quit caring if I got dressed or not. I guess just because your friend got killed, you want me to forget what you did and make it all right? I'm not sorry for you. You'd have left Billy, too, just like you left me. I bet you left him plenty of nights. Whenever J.C. whistled, I wouldn't treat a dog that way. I guess you thought I was so old and ugly, you didn't owe me any explanation. You didn't need to be careful of me. There wasn't anything I could do about you and her. Why should you be careful of me? You didn't love me. Look at me. Didn't you even look at me?
And that's Cloris Leachman in a scene from The Last Picture Show. Was it at all awkward to be starring in that film opposite a teenager?
Strangely, no. But I think he was very embarrassed. He didn't say anything at the time, but later he said, well, I was in bed with a middle-aged woman. God, I was 45 years old.
Did you talk about this kind of stuff before the shoot?
No, not a word. But we went into the bedroom, the little room in the house, to do that scene. And he said, I ain't taking my clothes off for this scene. And Peter and I looked at each other. So we started to design the scene without taking our clothes off. So there were two closets, one on either side of this dresser. And so I went into the first one. He went into the other one. We took off our outside clothes. I left on my bra and panties, and he had his shorts on. And we made our way to the bed, and each got in his own side. And then they had planted some underwear in there for us to throw out, so it looks as if we took it off under the covers. And now it's action. And all the lighting was done. We did what I just described to you, and we got into bed. And I took my underwear off and threw it out. I forgot to keep it on and throw out what was planted there. I mean, I was playing my part. So we had to do it again.
That's probably the scene that won you the Oscar.
Well, no doubt. And the producer called him before it came out. They had to cut it. It was too long. And they'd cut it as much as humanly possible. And finally the producer called and said, Peter, I have the perfect answer. Because they had to cut some. He said, when Timmy drives away in his pickup, that's when we should end the picture, and all the credits can come under his driving away. It'll be really good. Peter said, no. And he insisted and fought for and kept my scene in, and that's, of course, why I won the Oscar.
My guest is Cloris Leachman, and she's written her autobiography. You know, I went through a list of all of your movie and TV credits. And I realized looking at that list that you guest star on just about every TV show I grew up with. I will now read an abridged copy of that list. Lassie, Perry Mason, Dr. Kildare, Mr. Novak, The Defender, 77 Sunset Strip, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Wagon Train, Laramie, Route 66, The Untouchables, Twilight Zone, The Donna Reed Show, Gunsmoke, Hawaiian Eye, Checkmate, Wanted Dead or Alive, and Rawhide. Wow, how did you manage to guest star on so many TV shows?
Well, I was always building my house and improving it and fixing it up, making it more beautiful. So I always needed money to do that, and that helped me. I don't know, I think I tried not to do the same kind of role every single time. One time I was doing suspense. He would hire me every week to do something. So this one time I got a part, I said, this is just like I did, 4 weeks ago to myself. And I thought, no, I don't want to do the same thing. And I had to find other aspects of this same kind of character, which was tricky, it's difficult. But I did it, and I was very happy about it. And I think that was a basic decision for the rest of my life, that I would never be the same way twice.
Well, thank you. Thanks for talking with us. And
you're
be well.
Very welcome. It was okay. Very good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Cloris Leachman has written her autobiography. Saxophonist Lucky Thompson was in the thick of jazz for 30 years, playing with Armstrong and Basie and Monk and Stan Kenton, and making records of his own in the U.S. and all over Europe. He dropped off the scene in the 1970s and never returned, passing away in 2005. Some rare, live Lucky Thompson is now out. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that's good luck for us.
Lucky Thompson's Octet with Richard Davis on bass at New York's Little Theater in 1964. Thompson was a real saxophonist, not a household name in jazz maybe, but I know some tenor players who scarf up every note they can find. I expect they'll be elated by the new set Lucky Thompson, New York City, 1964-65 on two CDs from the indie label Uptown. Thompson loved mid-size ensembles that maneuver like a small group and hint at the hurly-burly of a big band. His octet sounds a little like Sun Ra in the 1950s. Lively as the writing is, the real attraction on these rediscovered live dates is Lucky Thompson's saxophone. Like his early idol Don Byas, he could play in and with different dialects, modulating his voice like a stage actor. You can spot some swing-era swagger, Stan Getz's pleading tone, and a little restless Coltrane, but Thompson used all that inspiration to sound more like himself, to expand the expressive qualities he had already. I think that's why saxophonists love him. He shows how to fold influences into a well-rounded style of your own. This is 'Twas Yesterday. The other half of the new Lucky Thompson set is a 1965 nightclub broadcast with a quartet giving him even more room to run. He was one of the first modernists to pick up the unfashionable soprano sax in the late 1950s, after Steve Lacy but before John Coltrane. Lucky's liquid tone falls between Lacy's watery purity and Coltrane's vinegar bite. Lucky Thompson hated the music business, hated how promoters and critics and publicists tried to categorize musicians as hot or cool, swing or bebop. He was above all that. "I fought all my life and said, you'll never stereotype me," he told an interviewer after he gave up performing. His cool charts and hot playing, his hard or soft tone on two saxophones all made Lucky Thompson too slippery to pin down. That was a good artistic choice and maybe a bad career move.
Kevin Whitehead is currently on leave from teaching at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Lucky Thompson, New York City, 1964-65, on the Uptown label. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.